The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And today on Armchair Traveler, we share the story of an amateur archaeologist whose steadfast efforts brought a new perspective on the history of the Roman Empire. Now, writer Julian Sancton's story, The Buried Treasure That Might Have Changed History, appeared in the August 2025 issue of National Geographic. As the editors note, 2,000 years ago, the Roman army embarked on a far-flung hunt for silver. Now, thanks to a persistent archaeology buff, we're now learning how close they came to funding an empire-altering fortune. And I'm going to begin with the caption to an illustration titled Funding an Empire as we begin this series. So it says, the Roman Empire reached its greatest extent by the 2nd century A.D., fueled in part by a search for resources beyond what Italia could offer. To make its currency, luxuries, and weapons, Rome needed the silver, gold, lead, and iron deposits found elsewhere. Over the course of more than 4 centuries, it obtained them by conquering and absorbing other lands. Then there's some brief statements here. The first one, early successes. Rome takes control of metal-rich areas in Hispania following the Second Punic War, and this occurs between 2018 and 2001 B.C. Now, for centuries, most Roman silver originates here. Number two, imperial setbacks. A crushing defeat at the Battle of Teutoburg Forest in AD 9 halts a large expansion effort across the Rhine, but mining forays still continue. And then number three, striking it rich, pushing into Eastern Europe, Rome conquers Dacia, known for its gold and silver deposits, and starts mining its riches in the early 2nd century AD. Now let's go to the main story. The passage is easy to miss. A paragraph-long anecdote in the Annals by the Roman historian Tacitus, it tells a story found nowhere else about an unpopular legate forcing legionaries into a treacherous mine at the frontier of the empire. It takes place during the reign of Claudius, AD 41 to 54, a time of furious expansion when Rome sought to swallow up the borderlands and their resources. The location mentioned in the Tacitus passage is vague, described as in the district of Matium, just outside of Rome-occupied Germania Superior. But the goal is clear, to find more of a metal that powered the realm. Silver trickled down from patricians, officers, and soldiers to the rest of the economy in the form of coins and ingots and jewelry. Coins were not merely currency. Stamped with the profile of the emperor, each one served as a symbol of his power as it circulated across the land. The bulk of Rome's mined silver had until then come from Hispania, modern-day Spain and Portugal, but prospectors had long sought other deposits across the dominion. In Tacitus' telling, the legionaries were worn out by the arduous, dirty, and dangerous task of mining, of digging out watercourses and constructing underground workings, which would have been difficult enough, in the open, let alone in the stifling darkness, broken only feebly by the glow of oil lamps. To voice their displeasure, the legionaries wrote a letter to the emperor asking him to recognize the efforts of their unpopular commander, Curtius Rufus, with triumphal honors. Such an acknowledgment, they hoped, would permit Rufus to drop the largely fruitless effort. Eventually, the search for silver was abandoned and the army's encampment destroyed. Tacitus' story long intrigued classical scholars, who could find no evidence nor any other mention of such an undertaking. Some scholars dismissed it as colorful but unverifiable aside. Now, Alfred Hurt of the University of Liverpool, a specialist on Rome's economy and mining operations, called it an example of so-called mirabilia, which are these kind of wondrous stories that are being told just to regale readers. But a recent discovery that has electrified the archaeological world suggests that Tacitus was outlining a real episode. Rufus and his men indeed searched for silver, it seems, but decamped before hitting the mother lode. We now know there was enough silver in the region to have altered the course of the empire, but the enormity of their near miss would not become clear until millennia later, after a persistently curious German hunter put all the pieces together. On a crisp evening in April 2016, a 72-year-old former paratrooper named Jürgen Eigenbrod was stalking boar in the hills around the historic spa town of Bad Ems in Rhineland-Palatinate. He noticed an unusual pattern in a grain field, two parallel yellowish strips cutting across a blanket of green. Few other passers-by would have made anything of it. They were too wide to have been a truck or tank tracks. Conspiracy theorists might have suggested an extraterrestrial origin, but Eigenbrod knew better. He had served with the Blue Helmets in Somalia and as a defense attaché in Tel Aviv, but since retiring from the German military in 2003, he had turned his attention to goings-on closer to home, if far distant in time. Eigenbrod had become fascinated with the archaeology and history of the Bad Ems environs and had even led a number of small-scale excavations of the Lahn Valley as a volunteer. Amateur though he was, he recognized the crop marks as the sure sign of human-made structure, keeping in mind a core tenet of archaeology. There are no straight lines in nature. Something's beneath the ground had changed the density of the soil, causing the vegetation at the surface to mature at a different rate. But what? To get a clearer view, he asked his old friend Hans Joachim de Roy, a retired frigate captain and fellow history buff, to photograph the field from above with his drone. The aerial shot revealed that the parallel lines made a right-angle turn. The corner was rounded, like a playing card. Eigenbrod's pulse quickened when he viewed the image. He had seen depictions of such a configuration before. There was only one thing it could be. The markings were the unmistakable traces of the defensive double trenches Roman troops commonly dug around military camps at the fringe of their empire. Eigenbrod's work had only just begun. He had to convince the archaeologist of Rhineland-Palatinate in Koblenz to do some digging. And fortunately, he did it like a pain in the ass, said de Roy. It was like the work of Sisyphus. Worn down by Eigenbrod, the state's archaeology department eventually agreed to conduct a geomagnetic survey of the surrounding area on what is known as the Ehrlich Plateau. Measuring infinitesimal variations in the Earth's magnetic field, the survey revealed several other stretches of the double trench, confirming it had marked the perimeter of a 19-acre Roman encampment with fortifications of soil and wood. Excavation of the Ehrlich camp began in 2017, led by archaeologist Thomas Maurer and supervised by Peter Henrich of Rhineland State Museum in Trier and Marcus Schultz of Goethe University in Frankfurt. They have initially believed the site to be from the time of Augustus, that was 27 BC through AD 14, perhaps one of the countless temporary marching camps Roman troops erected while on the move. Such camps have been found across Europe, often thanks to crop marks, but Frederick Auth, a doctoral student supervised by Schultz, put it bluntly, as archaeological finds go, they were not so spectacular. However, Eigenbrod wondered whether Ehrlich might not instead have been a more noteworthy encampment. He was familiar with the enigmatic passage from Tacitus. The mention of the Mataiaci was an early clue, as they were a Germanic tribe who had settled near Bad Ems. Eigenbrod, who knew that the surrounding area had long been mined for silver, grew even more or ever more convinced that the camp he had discovered was related to the mining operation, Tacitus noted. Well, perhaps it was where the disgruntled legionaries had been stationed, he thought. Now, to the professional archaeologist, Eichenbrod's hypothesis reflected the touching naivete of a dabbler. The archaeologist told the enthusiast this wasn't how the discipline worked in real life. It's quite difficult to connect archaeology and historical literature, Oth said, and we tend to be very careful not to overinterpret that literature because Tacitus has never seen Roman Germany. The hunter's undiminished enthusiasm nourished the excavation, literally, as he kept the workers fed with homemade boar sausage. Those sausages are quite the legend among the students, Oth recalled. I was giving a talk in Bad Ems, and my monetary compensation was actually more sausages from said boar. The dig unearthed, among other artifacts, a brass ring from a horse's harness, iron nails, and slag, but precious little that might have allowed a precise date for the site. The archaeologist's best clue was a heavily corroded bronze coin depicting a barely decipherable profile of Emperor Caligula, evidently minted in Rome in 37 or 38. Then a coin of copper alloy from the subsequent Claudian period was discovered at the bottom of a former well. Coins could circulate for a long time, especially during Claudius' reign, when few were minted, making it difficult to narrow down the time frame. But when combined with recovered shards of pottery, including plates and jugs, characteristic of the mid-first century, the finds led the team to date the Ehrlich camp to the 40s or early 50s. In other words, smack in the period Tacitus was writing about in the annals. Eichenbrod's theory wasn't yet vindicated. The time frame of Ehrlich may have aligned with Tacitus, but without evidence of a contemporaneous Roman silver mine, it could have merely been an intriguing coincidence. Finding such evidence would not be simple. The area around Bad Ems had been mined for various metals from biblical times up until the Second World War, and is consequently riddled with pits, shafts, and tunnels, several of which are still accessible. Some of these pits may be of Roman origin, said Schultz, but they were reshaped in the medieval times or during the last few centuries. In addition, the region had been heavily bombed in the war, making it difficult to distinguish craters from ancient mines. We're quite glad that Jürgen Eichenbrod was ex-military so he can tell them apart, said Oth. Rather than attempt to find an undiscovered mine in a landscape full of holes, Eichenbrod insisted that the archaeologists shift their efforts to a nearby Roman site that had been known for a long time. The remains of a small fortification on a barren hilltop less than a mile and a half called Blaskov, literally Bearhead. The site had been the subject of an 1897 study by retired Lieutenant Colonel Otto Dahm, who, like Eichenbrod, had thought he'd found the elusive silver mine mentioned by Tacitus. Dahm concluded that Blaskov had indeed been a smelting facility that he dated back to the end of the 2nd century, far too late for Tacitus. At Eichenbrod's urging, Ott took another look at Blaskov. He found that Dahm's 19th century publication was, quote, pretty much full of errors, unquote, showing few finds and methodologically sloppy. With far more archaeological rigor and technology unknown in Dahm's day, including LIDAR to map the underground, Oth led a new excavation that unearthed a pair of coins from the time of Claudius or earlier, and none from the following reign of his adopted son, Nero. Now, the coins confirmed it. The large Ehrlich camp and smaller Blaskov outpost were, in fact, contemporaneous and most likely related. What's more, the Blaskov structure lay in an area now known to be a rich source of silver. Roman prospectors probably would have used several cues in the landscape to determine that Blaskov could be a fruitful place to mine. The larger Ehrlich camp most likely served as the main Roman base in the area, which supplied the legionaries who worked the Blaskov mine and manned the outpost. Based on this suspicion, Oth brought Eichenbrod to the tunnel that pierced through Blaskov Hill, along with Roman mining specialist Marcus Helfert, who confirmed it was almost certainly of Roman origin. This was enough for the archaeologist to admit that Eichenbrod had been right all along. These were likely the places Tacitus was writing about. Several weeks into the Blaskov excavation, Oth and his team made a discovery that corroborated yet another passage from Roman history. In one pit nearly 6 feet down, Oth and his team found what looked like the spiky backbone of a prehistoric monster. They cleared the reddish earth around it, revealing a series of sharpened wooden stakes jutting out at staggered angles and embedded in the bottom of a trench that once surrounded the outpost. Designed to thwart any would-be attackers, the obstacle appeared analogous to a defense Julius Caesar had described in his writings on the war in Gaul, a century before the Bloskov fort was built. Quote, whoever entered within them were likely to impale themselves on very sharp stakes. Caesar's troops called the spikes Sippi. Oth and his colleagues would call the version they found pila fossata, or trench stakes. Such dangerous devices are believed to have surrounded camps around the Roman world, but they have never been found in situ before or since. Just as thrilling as the discovery of the stakes was the miracle of their preservation. For two millennia, the dense, oxygen-poor soil had remained just moist enough to keep the stakes waterlogged and structurally stable. The pila fossata were extracted in 2019 and may have been conserved, according to Oth, just in time. Increasingly dry soil, he says, would have caused the wood to finally begin decaying, eventually destroying this precious testament to Roman ingenuity and ruthlessness. One can imagine the murderous spikes protecting the camp indefinitely had the empire not abandoned its mining efforts. The likely confirmation of Tacitus' account raised the question, how much silver had Rufus's men missed? Oth's study of Bloskov revealed that the Romans got tantalizingly close to a source of silver-bearing ore that may have rivaled the richest mines of Hispania, the so-called Imser Ganzug, or Ems vein, which spans 10 miles from the north of Bad Ems to the Rhine River. It is estimated that more than 200 metric tons of silver were extracted in the modern era, before mining operations in Bad Ems were finally shuttered in the last weeks of World War II. If they had known about the silver, and if they had found the right spot, Oth noted, the Romans would have had the opportunity to exploit Bad Ems. Silver for around 200 years until they abandoned their possessions on this side of the Rhine altogether. Roman forces had a secure hold on Germania Superior, but not on Bloskov itself. They retreated west over the Rhine around 260, 2 centuries before the fall of the Western Empire. It is tempting to imagine how much a silver bonanza could have extended the reach or duration or even hastened the decadence of Rome. Such counterfactuals are a perennial parlor game for historians, speculative as they must be. Had the legionaries succeeded in extracting all the silver that lay beneath their sandals, it would not have sufficed to fund the whole Roman Empire for centuries, but it certainly would have made a difference, said Oth. He cautioned that the silver-bearing ore was likely too deep for Roman technology of the time. The Roman authorities would have had no reason to linger in an area if they didn't find a resource they could easily exploit. If we don't succeed effectively, Schultz summarized Roman thinking, then we drop it and go elsewhere. Jürgen Eigenbrod died of a heart attack in 2023, less than a week after a flurry of breathless press reports focused on the irony of the overlooked silver motherlode. He lived to bask for a few short days in the glory of his contributions to archaeology and history, just as the Romans had 2,000 years before. He had gazed upon the land with an eye for the wealth that lay beneath, but unlike them, he had found what he had been looking for. And there are several graphics done by artist Aria Safarzadeh that include, tell us rather more about the Romans' quest for silver. And let's take a look at some of these. If you'll give me a moment here, I've got them marked. We've got to go through some pages. The first one is called Exploring the Frontier. It says, built on hilltops a little more than a mile apart and in direct line of sight of each other, the Ehrlich military camp and Bloskov defensive outpost were constructed alongside a system of Roman fortifications dotting the Rhine River valley in the first century A.D. Legionaries stationed here may have both worked in and protected the nearby prospecting mine before the Roman army abandoned it and missed a giant source of silver. And it talks about the Bloskov site, saying variation in vegetation or evidence of prior surface mining might have signaled the presence of lead, which often commingles with silver, to Roman prospectors. And then about the Ehrlich camp, atop a plateau near the junction of two rivers, the Ehrlich fort spanned 19 acres. As many as 3,000 troops would have been quartered here in tents. And then there's the Ems ore vein. The Romans just missed a massive deposit of silver-bearing ore tapped here more than a millennium later. How amazing is that, huh? Well, our next one is a new story for an old site. For more than 100 years, scholars thought the small Roman fort on Bloskov Ridge was a second century facility, but new discoveries have corrected that record. Now, archaeologists recently uncovered evidence that identified the site as the mid-first century security outpost for the mine, housing between 12 and 40 men. Now, there was a terrain barrier that was part of this outpost. A 1,300-foot long wall extended north and south of the outpost to prevent assaults from the past. And we talked about those deadly spikes. Well, ditches and spikes is the next one. The two V-shaped defensive trenches protected the outpost. The inner, larger one, some 15 feet wide and 6 feet deep, was lined with these sharp wooden spikes that archaeologists named Pila Fasada. And before their discovery at Bloskov, none had ever been found in situ. Now, let's talk about the outpost a minute. Built in different phases over several years, the Bloskov fortlet featured sturdy stone walls, half-timber construction, and a style found across the Western Empire. Archaeologists today believe there were two or three levels within the higher floor and perhaps a balcony that was used for observation. And they've got a model here in this graphic of what it could have looked like. There was a main gate presumed to have been on the fort's west side. This wooden gate would have provided a secure access to the rampart and been wide enough for a cart to enter. And then on the rampart itself, topped with a fence of bundled sticks called fascines, an 8-foot-tall wall, earthen wall structure surrounded this particular structure. So, now we talk about this difficult and dangerous job, and this graphic talks about mining at Bloskov carried out by Roman soldiers who were accustomed to foraging materials and building forts, but not the back-breaking work of digging underground. Now, filled with threats from floods, noxious fumes, lack of air, and cave-ins, mining was typically the work of civilian laborers. And we'll talk a little bit about this process now, silver processing in the Roman era. First, we have the mining. Workers used iron tools to chip away at pieces of rock, which were taken out, crushed, washed, sorted, and roasted before smelting. If gallery walls were especially hard, laborers could build fires to weaken their surface. Now, evidence of smelting and cupellation has not been found at Bloskov, but archaeologists suspect they may have taken place in the nearby Emsbach or Lahn valleys. The next step in this process, smelting, involved charcoal and ore and what is called a shaft furnace. The metal ore and charcoal were placed in the furnace. Bellows pumped in air, causing the temperature to rise and melt the lead, which flowed out into a mold. Then we had this thing called cupellation. Now, this involved some charcoal, some molten silver, and a cupellation hearth. The lead placed in this hearth heated to more than 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 1,000 degrees Celsius. The metal separated as lead was oxidized, impurities were absorbed, and silver was collected. Now, they've got also a side view, if you will, of what this mining site looked like. The tunnel length ran about 755 feet here, and the shaft was not to scale, but you were lowered by a rope on kind of a winch-like device that was implanted into the ground, and you were lowered, and then you had this bucket of which the ore was brought up each time they had a load full. And the narrow tunnel is only about, get this, 2.6 to 3.3 feet wide. So these guys were not big guys. They probably wouldn't make a good football team. Anyway, they used a pickaxe and an oil lamp to get the work done. So let's hear some more details. Once the discovery, the via LIDAR scanning, archaeologists recently identified a shaft tunnel system west of the Bloskov outpost. Digging down, narrow vertical shafts were first dug to find and access the ore deposits. They also provided ventilation to the tunnel below. That was certainly important. And then we have tools working in tight spaces. Miners used a variety of iron tools, including pickaxes and hammers, to dig and extract the ore. Now, the visibility, the workers went long periods in the tunnel, which was poorly lit by terracotta oil lamps. And then we have removal. Oil, ore, and waste rock were hauled out of the mine in these baskets I described earlier and perhaps hoisted up through those shafts. And then transportation. After initial processing, ore was transported to a smelting site by a cart drawn by oxen, donkeys, or mules. And, of course, we talked about the smelting process a few minutes ago. So there you go. So, from the ancient forest of Germany, let's head over to Japan briefly, the last swordsmiths of Japan. This is written by Ellen Himmelfarb and has photographs taken by Noriko Hayashi. This appeared in the July 2025 issue of National Geographic. And as the page reveals, there were once thousands of artisans crafting traditional katana blades, and only a small number remain today. In a converted barn on a residential lane on Japan's Tango Peninsula, some 75 miles north of Kyoto, three men are playing with fire while robust flames lick the edges of a 2,300-degree furnace. Kazuki Yamazoi uses a 15-pound hammer on a mass of white-hot steel, flattening it beat by beat in a hypnotic rhythm. Behind the shower of embers raining down on the earthen floor, Tomoyuko Miyagi grips the steel with a pair of iron tongs and bangs a smaller mallet in a melodic counterpoint. Nearby, at a small stove next to a soot-covered wall, Tomoki Kuramoto is making tea. This is the headquarters of Nippon Jinshosha, one of the few remaining katana foundries in the world. Now, for hundreds of years, expert swordsmiths forged blades for Japan's warriors, including the famed samurai. Early records show craftsmen's names in the thousands, but a decline of the art began in 1876 with the outlaw of open carry. After World War II, the occupying forces in Japan then banned the production of katanas, resulting in additional lost works and livelihoods. Today, it is believed there may be some 200 licensed makers left, not all active. Yamazoi, Miyagi, and Kuramoto are only the katana artisans in a region that's home to one of the oldest blacksmithing workshops in all of Japan. There is a sadness that it's dying out as a craft, Kuramoto tells me through an interpreter, but together they are honoring and elevating the vanished art. The men, now in their 30s, met during a hard-sought 10-year apprenticeship in Tokyo with Yashikuza and Yashihara and his father, Yoshindo Yashihara, two of Japan's most illustrious swordsmiths. The elder Yashihara's work is in the New York Metropolitan Museum of Arts collection. He himself was the grandson of a celebrity swordsmith of the Showa period in the early 1900s. And after a brief stint working on their own, Yamazoi, Miyagi, and Kuramoto joined forces in 2019 and launched Nippon Jinshosha from an abandoned barn owned by Yamazoi's grandparents. Now, sword making has long been an art form in Japan, and experts can date a blade much as a porcelain appraiser can date a vase or an arborist a tree. Nippon Jinshosha swords, I should say, are entirely hand-built, average around $15,000, and are sought after by collectors. As with most katanas, they're made from tamahagane, a type of steel that comes from iron, sand, mined in the Shimane Prefecture north of Hiroshima. What a story there. Quite an art and quite a story. My friends, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next week. By the way, if you like travel stories, why don't you check out Our State Magazine? These feature some great travel places in North Carolina. And the program airs on Tuesdays at 11:30 a.m. and again repeated on Thursday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 1 p.m. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Again, the website, ncreadingservice.org. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.